Do we have any questions about the first 17 chapters? I mean, if we need to answer those before we move on, we can do that. The end of a chapter is a really good time to talk about everything. We're getting ready to get into the conversation of the aftermath of what chapter 17 was, which was the fall of Babylon. Or the description of Babylon falling. Chapter 18 is the actual thing happening. So it sounds to me like what John sees happens really quick. It's like, oh, that just, okay. I mean, that's practically how it goes. Because he just gets done talking. And the woman you saw is the great city, the royal power over the kings of the earth. After this, I saw another angel with great authority coming down from heaven. And the earth was illuminated by his splendor. He called out in a mighty voice, "It is fallen." Now, granted, this is a heavenly view, probably. Meaning John doesn't actually see the final fall. He sees something that tells him it's going to happen. And then you hear the announcement that it has happened. So, time-wise, it's kind of weird, possibly, but the first three verses of chapter 18, I read the first part, but it says, "He called out in a mighty voice, it is fallen. Babylon the Great has fallen, and she's become a home for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and despicable beast. For all the nations have drunk the wine of her sexual immorality, which brings wrath. The kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown wealthy from her sensuality and excess." And we can go on, but we don't need to right now. But, you know, there's the first angel in the announcement of Babylon falling. John is here and he watches this angel as it approaches and it appears and it comes down from heaven. So the question is, where is John? I don't know. It could be that it's a heavenly view. It could be that he's getting a view of what's happening on earth, or it could be that he's only seeing visions at this point of, you know, was the description of a woman riding a beast a literal description, or was that the best way he could describe what was happening? Was this is where you start to get questioning of what did John actually see? Did he see like a cartoon playing out but had a different meaning to it? Or was he seeing things and he said, well, the best way I can describe this is this way? Kind of like you or I might do. You know, we might describe something by using something that the reader would know without ever seeing what we're describing. We're seeing something different. Well, it was like this. It's the best I can do, but do you get the picture that I'm trying to paint kind of mentality? So here we are, and we see that out of all the angels which John has encountered, this is the only one which is said to have great authority. We're 18 chapters in, and here's the first angel that said to have great authority. Now, all of them had authority from God, which is great authority, but this is the first one that's described as saying, having great authority. The angel appearance is so powerful that earth was illuminated with his glory. That kind of leads you into the belief of what? This guy's important.
It's dark.
But the light from the angel is lighting the earth, which gives you the impression almost of a moon. You know how at night a full moon will light up the earth? You may not be able to see that well in places, but if there's a full moon, it's bright. The night can be bright because of the moon. So what light? You know, it's no ordinary angel. Several of the angels in Revelation have a loud voice, but this is the only one whose voice cried mightily. This angel has an authoritative message straight from the throne of God, and cries out mightily to share it. So in other words, it's a very likely case that this is one of, probably one of the archangels or one of the ones crying out completely. I mean, the angel has the authority to say Babylon has fallen. He's almost like a coroner. Babylon's dead, and he's here to make the final announcement. You know, the coroner has to call the death, or the doctor has to say that somebody's passed away. Well, it's kind of the same thing here. And he's basically proclaiming the end of civilization as we know it. The end of civilization as a whole. Babylon has been abandoned by human beings and has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison for every foul spirit. The only thing left is evil. Now, is it abandoned by humans because humans have repented? Or is it abandoned by humans because they've turned on the humans and left only the spirits in place? I would venture to say that based on the conversation as we ended chapter 17, that's possibly part of it. But the picture is almost poetic and symbolic. But we don't have to suppose that after the end of the age, wicked spirits will roam freely about the ruined places of earth. I don't think that's necessarily something that we see. It's a picture that's painted. It's kind of a spooky, Halloween-esque picture that we're seeing that gives you the notion of every unclean spirit, every unclean bird. Does anybody want to take a guess as what that might mean? What would the statement unclean bird mean? Or even a bat. Bat's not necessarily a bird. It's a mammal, but it flies. So, but yeah. I mean, you're right. The scavengers are what's left. The ones that survive on that kind of mentality.
What is it that makes you think, like, the light is like a full moon illuminating light?
Well, I'm not saying that it's like a full moon. I'm saying that it actually says that the angel lit up the earth.
I know, but what makes you think that it was that kind of light up and not like unblinded light up?
Well, I don't know. I'm saying it could be, but nothing's brighter than God, and the moon reflects the sun's light, which is, I was just saying, like, in general.
I just wondered if I missed something.
I wasn't saying that that's what the angel looked like at all. I was just saying in general, I said it could be like the moon or it could be like the sun. I mean, either one. We're more like the moon than the description of the angel here, because we are to reflect the light of the sun to the world. So, you know, like the moon does, if we're reflecting the light of the sun, then the world can see him because of us. Like, we can see the sun at night because of the moon, because it's reflecting off the moon's surface. But no, that's not what I'm saying. I was just comparing it. It had no real bearing as to me bringing up the moon on that. So, sorry for the confusion.
I just wondered if I missed something.
Oh, no. It was just me. Just comparison. Nothing really more than that. But then verse 3, we get into a conversation, and it's almost poetic how it then gives the reasons that Babylon falls. The general statement is made, which is followed by two specifics. The general statement, all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Or her fornicator, maybe. Either way, the nations have fallen because they have partaken in what Babylon had to offer. Basically, it repeats chapter 14, verse 8. I mean, chapter 14, verse 8, if we go back to it, says, and another, a second angel, followed, saying, "It is fallen, Babylon the Great is fallen. She made all the nations drink of the wine of her sexual immorality, which brings wrath." I mean, basically what these three verses are doing is they're repeating chapter 14, verse 8, which we've already seen. We're looking at a couple of different visions that could be the same thing, but maybe from different perspectives. So it kind of brings the ideas together at this point. First, the city used wine to intoxicate, then seduce the nations into immorality. The wine represents the enticements that civilization has to offer human beings. The fornication stands for corrupt religion or corruption in general, even politics possibly. Anything that involves the intertwining of beliefs to become a new belief would be considered in that statement. And most notably, probably because it's an appropriate symbol, probably used, especially seeing as a lot of religions the world has to offer do misappropriate the use of sex as a religious thing. For religious sacrifice or it's a hard word I'm trying to say there. God's gift of sex to a relationship, to a marriage, to a husband and a wife, to procreate, is a good gift that was given. Song of Solomon, great example. An example of a relationship that was done right. Anything else that is not a godly relationship that leads to that would be considered misappropriation of it. Some religions had sexualized their gods. Some religions have sexualized their priests. Some religions have even sexualized certain aspects of the ceremonies, up to even that they become acts of worship in some religions. This is how you worship your God. Not to say that it's not an act of worship within a right marriage, because it was created by God for the act of procreation to bring forth new life on the earth and give you the idea that God, of what God feels with his children, because you've created life. You know what that love feels like, and you understand a little more about the mind of God by having your own children. You understand a little more about the mind of God by having that aspect of your life. And if you are not partaking in it for those reasons, you know, basically, it's just misuse. It's misuse of God's goodness, God's good gifts. I just use the example of sex because it continues to tie through the entire section here of the sexual immorality. Well, how do you transfer and create new sexual immorality? Creates false new. It creates a new feeling where one shouldn't be. It creates a new belief system where one shouldn't be. So fornication could be tied to a number of different ways, not necessarily just in a relationship factor. If a religion and a political view are married together, and those leaders are fornicating the idea, it becomes a new belief system. I mean, we can see that in the world today, the way that things happen. So it's a deeper meaning, but it's a great example of how the two become one conversation happens. Just to throw all that in there at once. But it basically, the wine turns out to not delight, but to poison. The drink that is meant for good turns into poison, and it poisons the society. It poisons the situation. It becomes the cup distributing God's fury rather than God's grace. I mean, I think that's something we can definitely see throughout Revelation, is that the cup can be bitter or sweet, but it can never be bittersweet. And that's kind of the mentality here. You can't be on the fence. It's either bitter or sweet. Bitter's not good. Sweet would be fine, but it can't be both. It can't be that bittersweet taste because it's got to be one or the other. There's no middle ground. We've known that since 3:16 when it tells them to get off the fence, to stop being lukewarm. Stop. I'm about to spit you out of my mouth because you're neither hot nor cold. So the first group identifies here in Babylon's fall includes the kings of the earth who were seduced by what she offered. They were seduced by what Babylon offered. Whether it be monetary, whether it be favors, whatever it might be, what Babylon was offering was enticing to the point that the kings gave up their thrones. And that's evidenced in the fact that at the end of 17, you have, 10 who give up the throne to the beast. They give away everything that they are ruler over just because of the enticement that's there. The second group implicated in Babylon's fall shows that the harlot represents more than just simply false religions. It represents basically humanity. The merchants of the earth. Because humanity's unceasing demand for more comfort, more goods, more services, grew rich through the abundance of her luxury. That's right there in it. The merchants of the earth have grown wealthy from her sensuality and excess. Basically, everything about her has made them rich off of material things. We can look around us in the world today and see that. People that are taking advantage of people just solely based on the factor of wanting money. There's a reason why things aren't built to last now. When cars were first created, they would last forever. The idea was build something they could buy once and have as long as it would go. Now it's build something that they could trade in 2 years. It doesn't matter if it falls apart because that's just going to make them want something new. Cell phones. Nokia, there's a reason that there's a joke about a Nokia and that it's indestructible because it was. It was built to last. Well, now these things are built to last till your warranty goes out. And as soon as the warranty goes out, it's like there's a switch inside and they're going, all right, now turn it off. Because that way we get more money. We get more. And they're getting rich off the excess because they are. So it's the same type picture here. They get rich off the excess that's there. This pictures materialism, comfort, sensual gratification as having the power to bring wealth to those who satisfy the world at its basest desires. All right, materialism, the desire for stuff, the desire for vehicles, material things, whatever it might be, the nicest furniture, the nicest clothes, a wallet that you can't sit on because it's too high. There's so many different things there. Then you've got comfort, the biggest home, the biggest, the biggest couch, biggest chair. And it's silly to say, but it's true. You're looking at the more comfortable something is, the more it probably costs. But not only that, you're looking to hide yourself. You're looking to put yourself in a situation where you can buy your way out of circumstances. You're looking to find your way into things that aren't uncomfortable for you, whatever that might be. We look to satisfy a need for comfort. I am uncomfortable around these people. I need to get away from them. It could be that the discomfort that's happening is because of this book. What was it I saw the other day? It said, if the preacher's preaching and steps on your toes and it's lined up with the word, he's not the one that's wrong. If the preacher offends you and it's in line with God's word, who's wrong? Really. But we're so worried about comfort these days that we would rather tell the preacher he's wrong because it made us feel uncomfortable than to actually take it as advice and say, that out of God's word, that verse made me feel uncomfortable about things that I believe. I need to go back and review my life. What was the picture I saw the other day? It had a mother and father talking to the teacher, And it was like 2019. Well, the 1969 one was, it was the mother and father standing on the side of the desk with the teacher holding the report card in front of the kid and said, explain to us these grades. Do you want to explain these grades to us? The 2019 one was them on the side with the kid holding the report card in front of the teacher saying, do you want to explain these grades to us? And it was a, talking about the how it's flipped, how what used to be the kid's responsibility to learn, to do better and get better in school is now you've got the kid beaming behind the parents, basically saying, you know, I'm not going to get in trouble. I've done nothing wrong. Well, if you've not been doing the work, the same kid could have done the work in 1969, made a B. They get an F or a B now, even. You know, make the same grade that that kid would have. That kid's in trouble where this kid's getting, the teacher's getting yelled at because my kid's smarter than that. And we're handing things out because of that fear, but it's the comfort. We strive for that comfort. We want to be sitting on top, not in the middle. We don't want to have to work for it. We want to be sitting on top. Sounds like a lot of things, doesn't it? Sounds like a lot of things within the society that we look around us. We can see it. You know? I mean, I could go into a lot of details about it, but we don't have that kind of time. But then the sensual gratifications. That is a spiritual level. That is a physical level. That is a number of different levels. But it's all about wanting to feel that closeness, that oneness, that comfort with someone, when that is the intended relationship we are to have with God. The intended relationship that we're to have with God is one of sensualness, one that is an intimate relationship with God, where we talk to Him on an intimate and personal level, where we have that closeness in that regard. And if we are constantly seeking that from the world, we're not seeking from the right place. It's why movies have turned to sex. It's why just about everything has turned to that anymore. They've sexualized food commercials. I mean, has anybody seen a Hardee's commercial lately? I mean, what's the purpose of putting a woman in a string bikini on a beach eating a burger other than to get men in the door of the restaurant? You know, because when they go in there, they think, well, that burger looks good. No, it's when they walk in there, they look at the menu and they remember what they saw and they order it because they liked what they saw. It has nothing to do with the burger. It's the side of meat that was holding it. I mean, that's the reality. That's how marketing works. But that's what marketing plays to, is those parts, the uneasy, the unceasing demand for those things within man and humankind. The fact that we want to feel wanted, we want to feel comfortable, we want to have everything we want, and we want to feel close to people. I mean, is that not basically the base of human desire? That we want to have everything we want, we want it when we want it, we want to be comfortable while we get it, and we want to feel close to people because we don't want to feel alone. There's not a single person you will ever find on the face of this earth, no matter what they tell you, who will honestly say that they want to be alone all the time. If they do, there's a problem. And they're lying to you. Because not one person that you will ever come across doesn't have a desire to be around somebody at some point. And if they do, send them to me. Because I'm alone a lot of the time with the radio station and house, and I will gladly tell them how it feels. But it's not what you want. It's really not. I mean, but that's the desires that are in us are all for a relationship with God. They're all for us to find within that relationship with God something that is sensual, something that is gratifying, something that is comfortable. Even if the world doesn't think it's comfortable, you're comfortable within it, no matter how much discomfort is around you, because He is protecting you. You know, what is it? Psalm 91:1. I think is the verse I'm thinking. And it's the one I want to close with, actually. But, I mean, it's an interesting conversation we can have. because we can seek the pleasures that we want within the world, or we can seek God in the same way that we desire things in the world. But Psalm 91:1, the one who lives under the protection of the Most High dwells in the shadow of the Almighty. Or the one who, how is it worded in the King James? He who rests, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall rest in the shadow of his wings. There's a lot of truth to that. The shadow of his wings, it gives you the idea of a picture of a bird or an angel. If you dwell in the secret place of God, the place that is hidden, the place that only you and he can get together, the place that only you and he can find time to really grow intimate, to enjoy one another's company, that place, then that place exists under his protection. You dwell in the shadow. I mean, if you're sitting in the shadow of a tree, what is it? Comfortable. It's cool. The heat that the world is, or the sun is throwing at you, is not affecting you because you're in the cool. You're in the shade. You are covered. You know, the comfort of the shade tree in a rainstorm. If it's just a regular rainstorm and it's not wind blowing, not lightning and thunder, that tree will protect you from 90% of the drops that come out of the sky. You know, there's so much to a shade tree. And the same idea is given here with the shadow of the Almighty, or even the other translations of the wings. A mother hen, you know, the protection that a mother bird will put on their young. Watch a duck walk across the road with their ducklings behind, and then trouble comes. They nestle up to the mother and the wings go out and protect. And you'll see like 8 little legs sticking out from under wings, but you don't see the rest of the duckling because they're covered. They're in that secret place. They're being sheltered. They're being shadowed in that place. And that's us. I mean, that's kind of how the picture's painted here, but in an opposite way. But that's what Psalm 91:1 is. And it fits for us to see the contrast for what verses 1 through 3 of chapter 18 is talking about. Any questions?